All right. It's been quite a long session, but to take us through in a very elegant way, I'm sure we have Dr. Valerie Delpech. Valerie is head of HIV surveillance at Public Health England, and she's going to look at the metrics of success. Thanks, Valerie.
Thank you. I don't know, you know, when you've got this time slot, it's like the end of the conference. You're not sure if you're filling in and you're meant to be the comic at the end of the show or you're... But I know we're all exhausted. I mean, it's been an incredible couple of days and there's been so much said already. And the last thing I want to do is repeat everything that's been said. And certainly it's quite a privilege to be here, apart from the lights in which are very bright. Because I think, you know, we've got an assemble of what I think are amazing people who can actually make a difference. You know, we've got the researchers, the clinicians, the community activists, the patients, the commissioners, the funders, the sponsors. There's nothing really missing. Possibly a little bit more public health would have been good. And I'd like to thank a colleague from the US speaking about public health a little bit. But generally, everyone is here. I've been given a title that I don't understand, so I'm going to interpret the way I am going to understand it. And rather than talk about Cascade, which you've heard all about, I promise, firstly, that's my thank you to everybody here. As I said, what I haven't got here are the organisers to invite me to come and speak, but also to the sponsors, who I hope will continue to sponsor such events, even when the generics come in and the interest in HIV is not as great. This presentation, warning, will have surveillance data. A lot of researchers might be walking out of the room already. It's been very difficult to publish surveillance data over the years, and yet everything I'm hearing about the last couple of days is about getting routine data, systematic routine data of everyday practice somewhere where we can all read it. Now, whether it's not in published literature because it's not innovative enough, whether it has to be somewhere else, we need that data available so we can assess how well we're doing. And I promise not to have any cascades at all. So the reason we don't need a cascade necessarily in the UK, I'm just showing you the picture of Hampstead Heath, the men's pond. It's about half a minute's walk from where I live. It's a real pleasure to live there in Hampstead Heath. And as you can see, on a calm day like there, it is a wonderful place. And if you look at the continuum of care of people living with diagnosed HIV in the UK, it's pretty much a pond. There is no cascade. You're not diving into rocks. It's not the US. You're actually probably anticipate you'll be in care within 3 months. Just about everybody linked to care. Just about everyone is retained annually. There is a little bit of a drop-off, mostly around the newly diagnosed. Some of them are people who leave the country and return, or some people miss out a year. And then the majority of people who are offered treatment, according to Beaver guidelines at the moment at 350, take up the offer and are very well maintained and achieve negligible viral load. So, a success story. So apart from that initial diving board, which is all about the plunge and getting tested, once you're in that pond, it is actually a superb national health system, which it's one we need to treasure and keep monitoring to ensure we're performing as well as we should. And it is a real example of things that can be done. However, if you look at the extreme left of our cascade, why aren't we therefore getting to 100% viral suppression for everybody? Well, the answer is very obvious. It's all about the undiagnosed, as we've talked about, and mostly also a small proportion also to do with the fact that we haven't put everybody on treatment, as we've talked about, according to our guidelines. Also, just a small point here around all our different measurements. Viral suppression in some studies will be 1500 as seen as infectious or not. And if you use that definition, even all people living with HIV in the UK, we reach 66% versus less than 50, which is the 58% that we're quoting it. So it will vary on the type of publication you read. And of course, we know from a lot of data that there is ongoing transmission. I showed this last year, it's now been published. We did a back calculation with colleagues to look at the incidence among gay men, and basically it's a flat line in the UK at around 2,500 to almost 3,000 new infections every year. And the luxury of that back calculation, it also provides undiagnosed. And what you see here is that the undiagnosed has not changed at all, at around 8,500 to 10,000 gay men remaining undiagnosed in the UK. Now, that proportion, and we've got to be careful with proportion because I'm hearing a lot about the undiagnosed proportion going down. As the number of people living with diagnosed HIV goes up, the proportion can only go down. So we have to start talking about absolute numbers as well. So overall, we're seeing a slight decline in the undiagnosed, but that's because there's more people diagnosed. And if you unpack that a little bit more for the MSM, and thank you, Alison Brown, for all your work on this particular publication, which took a long time to get published and did get published on surveillance data, you can see here that of the undiagnosed, which is the pie chart, of which there are probably around 14,000, infectious gay men, according to the viral load counts, where we assume that everyone who's undiagnosed has an infectious viral load, then the large majority are among the undiagnosed. And if we increased the guidelines to 500, we would probably decrease that fraction by 12% only. Okay, so it's not going to be the answer either. We are still going to have the majority of gay men infectious because they're undiagnosed. And you can see that better in this representation where the absolute number here are represented. And of those diagnosed and treated on the far right, only 5% are infectious, which is what we expect with very good treatment and management. And if we increased those with the guidelines to 350 to 500, we would need to get an additional 1,600 men on treatment. But that would have probably a very minor impact overall on the number who is still infectious. And that was using copies of 1,500, so it would be slightly higher if you used less than 500. Over 50. The other good thing about the CD4 back calculation is that you can also look at what the CD4 count is likely to be among those undiagnosed on the left-hand side and also at the time of CD4, at the time of HIV diagnosis. And you can see basically it's a flat line. Nothing's changed very much. And that's, again, emphasis on the fact that we've had an incoming pool of incident cases despite the number of new diagnoses and testing. Although there is a suggestion on the right of a slight decline in CD4 count at diagnosis. And certainly we've seen a decline overall slightly of late diagnosis, so that now we're down to 30% of gay men presenting late. But it's still not enough. It's very, very little change for what should be an enormous change with all of the testing initiatives that have been going on. So a plug for good surveillance data, as I've said. It's actually not that difficult, and I actually make a plea that we should do this much more systematically, not just in Europe and the US and Canada and Australia, but in many other countries. We need basic routine surveillance data on who is diagnosed by risk groups. It's not that difficult. We need to make it happen. It's not publishable, so it doesn't attract a lot of the researchers, but we do need to get it. And then we probably need data pretty much in some way or another to understand better who's accessing care and what sort of viral load and CD4. Very similar again to my US colleague that spoke before. Systematic data that we can look at. And that's certainly the luxury and the legacy that I inherited coming to the UK system. And it's important, obviously, to have all the key stakeholders understanding why you're collecting that data. In the UK, there is no doubt, even though I always thank the clinicians and they do a marvellous job, that if SOFID, our survey of people accessing care, had not been linked to commissioning every year, I don't know how good the quality of the data really have been. And that is a strong lever. Why don't we make sure programs that we deliver actually have attached to them getting good quality data and it's linked to successive funding? And so these are the types of variables which we collect at very basic level, which are few demographic information, time of diagnosis, CD4 count, viral load. And with that, we can do some very powerful work, including some key outcome indicators that we develop in collaboration with clinicians and commissioners for the last few years and now have become very common practice and way of presenting data. Not only do we do that for the whole country, and having started that in London, but we can do that by site. And this is an example of one indicator there, as you can see, the proportion of individuals that are virally suppressed within 12 months of starting ART by actual service delivery. And you can see very little variation overall in that it's fairly much over 85%. We can also break that down further, looking at population groups. And this is where we start seeing a striking difference, again, with the US data that was presented earlier. We actually do not see that many differences. So although there are differences in the proportion that are diagnosed among the infected, once you start looking at the number retained in care, you can see we're up in the 90s. And those on treatment, slight variation, but fairly much, actually, we have, by demographic group and risk information groups, fairly much high all-round quality of care for the UK. What we focus mostly, given the issue of that left part of the spectrum being the most important, is the first year of diagnosis. And we've just published an overview of some results of this, where we've looked at late diagnosis, which is very different and is probably the most important marker to the outcome of an individual in the first year of diagnosis. You can see variations, quite important variation in late diagnosis at presentation. And certainly, although we know this CD4 at diagnosis can be variable, and we've looked at this by looking at our seroconverters, overall, we can use that to determine how long an individual more or less had their infection. And we also use that slope to determine whether or not those who've acquired their infection abroad or not, or who were not born in the UK and arrived in the UK recently, whether they may have acquired their infection within the UK or not, which is helpful to understand why many people are late diagnosed, particularly from origins of sub-Saharan Africa. Many of them probably acquired their infection beforehand. However, what we're finding is that up to a third of those are actually individuals who did acquire their infection in the UK, and therefore our prevention efforts and testing efforts within African communities have to be intensified alongside those of MSM. The other thing that's interesting with this seroconverters, which always strikes me, which is from 500 to 350, it's only about a year and a half or 2 years on average. So this whole argument of when do we start treatment guidelines is a little bit maybe in a lifetime course of someone with HIV, something I find perhaps something to be discussed, whether or not the value is as dramatic as we will find out to be. Okay, the other issues then of the first year of diagnosis that we want to focus on is linked to care, and we've talked about that and the importance of linked to care. And here, just to answer Andrew's question around what should we do in CDC, CD4 is a very powerful tool for people in routine surveillance. Not only tell you about late diagnosis, but the date itself is a proxy for entry into care, because most people will only get their first CD4 count when they have a baseline. And as Jane said, with the Beaver guidelines at 14 days within the UK, We've used 1 month, 3 months as showing how quickly people are in care. And as you can see here, overall, it's very high, so that within 3 months, it's 97% of everyone who's diagnosed. That means it's about 3,000 who are not reaching that, and we need to find out, sorry, not 3,000, probably a handful of those, we need to find out why they're not getting into care. But overall, we do very, very well. And note, no differences across demographic age groups or risk groups, which is very important again. And if we look at retention in care, within those diagnosed, because we found out when we did some loss to follow-up work that most of those loss to follow-up were among those newly diagnosed. But when we look more closely, in fact, the retention in care is exceedingly high even among those diagnosed. It's around 85% with little difference across groups. And I note that even among injecting drug users, people with injecting drug use, retention in care is 80% in the UK. Again, very, very high rates. Sorry, treatment guidelines is the other area. Once you've hit 350, particularly among those newly diagnosed, how quickly are they put on treatment? And again, as you can see, very few differences and very, very good uptake of treatment. But one could say it should be 100, not 90. And our main outcome at 12 months is short-term mortality. And this is a plug for mortality data. We still do not have very good mortality data for most countries in the world. We need to get a cause of death on data. We can't be estimating AIDS deaths anymore. We have to push for the cause of death on our death certificates. We're very fortunate to be able to link our data to the ONS, the Office of National Statistics, and get the absolute number of deaths among people living with HIV and match that to our data set each year. And you can see that the overall deaths rate for those in the first year is actually very low, provided that they are diagnosed with a CD4 count less than 350, but up to 1% of individuals aged over 50 who present late are likely to die in their first year. What can we do to avoid that? And it's probably not at the point of entering into care, it's at the point of getting tested earlier. And it's again about the opportunities to test and missed opportunity to test individuals. The next steps for us in the surveillance is to ensure that, along with these clinical outcomes and quality of care indicators, we add the patient experience. And we are rolling out a positive voices survey, which will be completed by people living with diagnosed HIV in their own time, a computer on a web-based questionnaire, which will cover a range of issues, both around how well, they live with their infection, but also access to treatment and their experience of various comorbidities and sexual behaviour. So that's something that we're planning to roll out. Again, very important. The US has done quite a lot of work already in this area, but what we're fortunate in here is that we have a very good sampling frame because we have absolutely everybody accessing care, and we can really pinpoint the questionnaires to ensure that we are getting a good representation. And this is a plug that although we're getting patient experience, what we don't necessarily do get are the structural changes. And this is a plug not necessarily for the UK, although there are still gender inequalities within the UK, but it's also in tackling generally, if we look at tackling structural disparities and using gender as an example, but probably for me the most important in many countries, until we tackle these inequalities alongside HIV and therefore it's not a separate issue to poverty and everything else, then I don't think we're going to make a major breakthrough in HIV prevention work either, particularly given it is a sexually transmitted infection. So last issue for me and around what the last couple of days was about, how do we translate a lot of this science into real world? And we've learnt and certainly have heard very eloquent, much more than me, very eloquent talks around the need for improved research in this area, also including the social science perspective, including patient experience perspective. But for me, it's also not focusing entirely on the RCTs and the science, although it's important, but making sure there is routine data, just picking up routine information that's happening and being able to scrutinise that information. It should be about involving all the key multidisciplinary team, and the local solution is not necessarily always translatable. And while we find solutions maybe through our RCTs, it becomes very difficult to perhaps translate those from one local setting to another. And that will take really a lot of time. But data on what works and sharing the data that works, how do we share that data? It's very difficult to actually pick up, if you're doing health promotion work, to know where to publish that information or have it accessible. And there's very little emphasis on good quality collection of data in delivering prevention and intervention work, and also healthcare delivery. Just an example, we've been working with the National Institute of Communicable Diseases in Africa, in South Africa, looking at improving some of the basic surveillance that is collected there. As you will know, most of the data that comes from South Africa on the number of people living with HIV and accessing care, etc., are very much driven from models. And the data sources of those are household surveys and antenatal care. What hasn't been really used is the central laboratory system, which is kept at the NICD, which has every CD4 and viral load that's conducted, which covers 80% of the South African population. So a huge resource where there hasn't been necessarily the time or skill set to be able to look at that data. Over 13 million counts, CD4 counts have been entered into that database with very basic information since 2004. And just looking at that, and this is very preliminary data that we're working with, and I'm very thankful for the team in the NICD for sharing these couple of slides. As you can see, the data shows that there's been at least a CD4 count, so at least 3 million people who had a CD4 count from that database covering 80% of the country in 2010. Two-thirds of those were women. And if we compare that to the estimated number of people living with HIV, you can see that it's reaching only 50% of people. So that would be their beginning of their cascade. And certainly it doesn't actually tell us the number who were tested. Many people were tested on point-of-care tests, but it gives us a first entry into care, and subsequently we can look at that in more detail to also look at what the actual CD4 count was over time. And as you can see, it is improving over time. But when we look at this distribution of CD4 counts of all of these individuals, and these have been deduplicated for each individual, you can see that, in fact, the blue line there, only just over 20% of people who had a CD4 count had a CD4 count above 500 of the 3 million people who had a CD4 count in South Africa that year. That means it's a lot of people who are not either on treatment or, in fact, successfully treated. And that's a lot of work if we're going to push these guidelines, the WHO guidelines further. So it's just an example, again, that a basic laboratory data of this type has a lot of benefits, and we're certainly looking forward to working more closely with NICD to understand these data sets and use them for understanding also those newly diagnosed, late diagnosis, and incorporating that as a routine surveillance report, which there is none at this stage. But there are a lot of obstacles in doing that, and probably one of the key obstacles is capacity and epidemiological and public health capacity. And that's something that we should really put into the mix if we're going to be collecting data both at the local level but through to the national level in a lot of countries. We need to make sure there are the skill sets available. Flipping back to the UK just to finish off with, and again, the importance of just using simple CD4 counts one of the things that the levers of collecting such data has been linked to commissioning, and now every service will have a dashboard available to them. And this is an example of, you can't quite read, but they include proportion of patients with a CD4 count linked to care within a month, 3 months, and retained in care. And so these are markers that every single service in the UK will be able to look at and also compare with other services. So again, it's very important information that can be provided quite frequently and quite timely to ensure services feel that they can use these as a potential for audit tools and making sure that they reach high standards for all patients. And finally, it's about, back to the UK, for us the challenge is taking that plunge, because it is a pond. There is excellent care, but what we don't have is enough testing, and enough testing frequently, particularly in our key populations. The routine testing, although we've had now national guidelines, and David was involved in producing those for quite some time, we are not seeing the level of testing that many other countries are seeing. And certainly only 25% of gay men are testing annually at best, and that is just not high enough and good enough. That doesn't stop primary prevention and the use of condoms, which need to be maintained, but certainly I think pushing the agenda for more testing and more frequently testing will be really our next success story in making sure that the pond stays the pond and includes those that are also undiagnosed. This is a HIV testing week that's being launched at the European level, which has a lot of resources for a lot of countries. The testing week across Europe will be later in November this year. I think, again, the advantage of this sort of initiative, where it contains a lot of information around the rationale for testing, groups to test, and engaging community as well as government across Europe in various settings to try and improve testing rates is important. There are already about 150 organisations signed up to this initiative, and hopefully by the time the testing week launches, we'll see a lot more. Thank you very, very much for your attention.
We'll take two or three minutes of questions. So, Julio.
Thank you for that presentation. It was very elegant and comprehensive. There is one area that you did not address. You referred to the 500 CD4. If you were to increase the coverage with antiretroviral therapy, that would make a small contribution to the number of people on treatment, and I understand that. But Jane went out of her way to emphasize that the British guidelines also incorporate a criteria that I think is very important, where treatment be offered to individuals in sexually discordant couples. You did not refer to that group at all, so it seems that there is a guideline out there, but it's not even being monitored. But I think that would be a very, very critical group to address separately.
The guidelines have just come in, and certainly we will be able to look over time the number of people who take up the offer of testing in those groups, because we do have that data, and the patient survey will also be asking the uptake of taking the option of taking data, taking treatment at a CD4, regardless of CD4, for prevention. But you're absolutely right, but the guidelines have just come in, so we wouldn't expect to see that change at all, which is why I haven't been showing it. So the size of the group I showed you already... Oh, how many are in serial discordant couples? David?
I mean, I guess the number of people who are starting because of that issue, because it may not just be couples, it may just be the issue of trying to reduce risk of transmission.
Focus won't be serial discordant couple. It will be just for public health purposes, right, protecting apartments. Yeah.
Ken?
Yeah, it was a very impressive talk, and certainly a lot of... resource-rich environments could learn a lot from the way you do surveillance here. One quibble and one question. The quibble is just using the threshold of 1,500 for infectiousness, since you have mainly an MSM epidemic. I believe that 1,500 threshold is from the RACAI data, which is primarily heterosexual transmission. So I think your sensitivity analysis should probably use different numbers, but that's certainly not a magic number to my mind, unless you have other data. So the question is, are you using any molecular epidemiology to try to track some of the outbreaks so that you can, because saying that all gay men should get tested, gay men come in all sizes and shapes, and if you're trying to focus limited public health dollars about encouraging testing, perhaps having a sense of, you know, are people meeting in saunas, meeting online, a sort of mixing of different types, I think would be of interest.
Thank you for that. The 1,500, you're right, was at the time when that paper was published, but we're using less than 50 now. Certainly, I think, because it's sort of standard, or less than 200, depending on the technology. There is quite a bit of phylogenetics work going on, mapping and looking at core groups and risk groups and association with STIs, and that's one piece of work, although by the time you match all that, it's a little bit in the past, if you like, but can have implications for future prevention work. What we are about to do is also provide a questionnaire to newly diagnosed but also recently infected, according to the Avidity RITA test, to gay men, particularly in London, in the high-risk areas. And as people have heard probably in the last couple of days, we're seeing higher rates, particularly in London, and we're quite concerned of what's going on here. This provides us an opportunity to really ask individuals what may have been issues such as attending saunas, drug use, etc., for that population, and really treating that almost as an outbreak tool to understand what's going on. And partner notification really comes into that, and I didn't, again, we've talked about that in the last couple of days, but how do we make sure partner notification is prioritised in those groups where we believe that transmission is occurring more frequently?
So two last questions, one here.
Yes, I think Julio took part of my question, so I'm going to skip the question. I'm just going to make the comment. Because the UK national health system has been always admired by the rest of the world. But the thing that I wanted to highlight is that yesterday the United Kingdom announced that 1.6 billion of new contributions to the Global Fund. So I think that's something that is going to really help the rest of the world of getting rid of cascades and making more like British pounds. And so I sincerely hope that amount to the Global Fund be really used for treatment mainly and not for something else. But I really wanted to congratulate the United Kingdom for that contribution. Yes.
On behalf of the UNAC.
Yeah.
Thanks. Ruben Grimes from UNAIDS. I just wanted to say that in our annual report, we'll have a traditional cascader. I don't really know what to call it, but it's basically a cascade where you start with the denominator of everybody who has HIV, and then you go down. And I found myself, and I think it might be a case of the, you know, what is it, the same people sharing a different language. I mean, I found myself during your talk doing the mental calculations to figure out what a traditional cascade would look like. So I know that you think that you have a pond, but maybe some of us in the crowd think that you might probably still have a cascade there in terms of what's happening in terms of viral suppression. But so that was just my comment, but my question is actually, when you brought up the European Testing Week, which UNAIDS is, I think, going to get behind, that actually raised a really interesting question for me, is that with the ease of travel, and we go back and forth from Switzerland and other places, are you going to see medical tourism from, let's say, from England to France when they raise their make it easier to get on ART? Or have you been seeing that or thinking about that? Or to Africa, if African countries go to earlier? I mean, I just wonder about that. Or vice versa. I don't know. There are probably countries in Europe that maybe it's a question for the gentleman from ECDC. But, I mean, is that starting to happen? Probably, right? Mm.
So the two things. Thank you. The reason I didn't show the cascade, it's been shown a number of times, so I will give you that slide if you like, and I just didn't want to show the US cascade. The issue of health tourism is something that has been raised as a concern, and certainly there is, in fact, consultation going on in the UK around who should access healthcare and health tourism, etc. When we look at our SOFA data so far, when we look at our data, there is no evidence of health tourism to the UK. People who come are coming for all sorts of range of reasons, but we're not seeing people coming just for treatment and leaving again. They are actually, most of them are very long-term residents.
What about the reverse, which is actually more of a
to get tested? somewhere
well,
else?
I mean, the idea is that if you want earlier access to treatment, you just go to France because they're going to offer it soon at less than 500 or some other country. You know, is that happening?
Speaking as a clinician, I mean, certainly there's enough flexibility in the guidelines, which are just guidelines. They're not so prescriptive that you've got a commissioner saying you can't treat that person. So I think if someone certainly came in and requested treatment, then, I mean, you'd have to look around the country and see if there's uniformity of how people interpret the guidelines, but I think most people would go ahead and treat that person.
Okay, and it's not an insurance issue. So. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you for a great session.